This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, experts tell us a big earthquake in California is inevitable. Is enough being done to prepare for it? Surface mining usually destroys the landscape and leaves a wasteland. In Madagascar, a sand mining project will create a forest in a land that needs wood. Professor Richard Nunley reflects on the blazing foliage of the New England fall. How do the early writers of New England miss it? And on the Earth calendar, organic field corn is being picked in Wisconsin. It's part of a great American harvest. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. It was 10 years ago that a large earthquake shook San Francisco, killing dozens of people, injuring many more, and disrupting the lives of thousands. Damage from the quake was widespread, with bridges, homes, businesses, and other structures being destroyed. Property damage was in the billions. 5 years ago, a similar-sized earthquake occurred near Los Angeles, measuring 6.7 on the Richter scale. The Northridge quake also killed more than 50 people and caused over $15 billion in damage. While residents of these areas have almost become accustomed to earthquakes, they have yet to experience the so-called big one, which seismologists say will inevitably occur. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on how emergency response officials in these regions are preparing for a massive earthquake.
Scientists predict Los Angeles will experience a massive earthquake sometime in the future. So, emergency response officials say they are planning for when the big one hits, not if.
Frankly, I have no reason to doubt them, because if you look historically what has happened in this region, it has pretty much been like clockwork within a range of, I think, every between 150 and 300 years. There are major magnitude earthquakes that happen along the San Andreas Fault, and there are similar patterns up in the Bay Area. So there's no reason to believe that something that has been going on for centuries is now going to not occur. They base their prognosis, if you will, on what past history has told them.
That's Constance Perrette, administrator for the Los Angeles County Office of Emergency Management. Her office is responsible for overall preparedness for a major earthquake in the L.A. area, which includes 88 cities. The Office of Emergency Management plans for emergency response and recovery and works to coordinate the efforts of the Department of Public Works, utilities, community organizations, and other groups.
The way we're set up in this county, we have what we call 8 lead county departments for emergency operations. And the sheriff is the director of emergency operations once we have a declared disaster. Our fire department plays a prominent role, as does our Department of Health Services and our emergency medical services system. Our Department of Public Social Services is very critical because they have responsibility for mass care and shelter operations and other types of human services. They work very closely with the American Red Cross.
In addition to local organizations and departments, the L.A. County Office of Emergency Management works with state and federal agencies like the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, to prepare for major disasters. Despite strict construction codes, a powerful earthquake could have devastating effects on downtown L.A. Some have estimated that the broken glass alone from surrounding buildings could pile 12 feet high. Constance Perrette says it's a terrifying prospect and says there would likely be a lot of injuries and fatalities. It's also likely that some local firefighters, police officers, and other emergency personnel would have their own emergencies to attend to, such as family members in need. So backup teams have been created to make sure the resources are available to attend to other residents. Medical facilities outside the greater L.A. area would also provide assistance. Another potential problem could be the ability of emergency officials to get to injured residents. Los Angeles is an expansive city, heavily dependent on roadways, and if a major quake hit, emergency personnel could find it difficult to respond to people in need. Constance Perrette says officials have addressed that problem.
We do have what we call disaster routes here in Los Angeles County that have been mapped by our Public Works Department. And those routes are what we call primary for incoming and outgoing during a disaster. And if we needed to redirect traffic or take alternative measures, we would be relying heavily on those maps.
Overall, Perrette believes the Los Angeles County Office of Emergency Management is prepared for the big one, but adds that when it comes to earthquakes, anything can occur. She says her office is always trying to improve preparedness by updating planning, communications, and purchasing new technology. Scientists say San Francisco is also at risk of experiencing a large earthquake in the near future. Just recently, researchers with the U.S. Geological Survey predicted that there is a 70% probability that the Bay Area will be hit by a quake measuring at least 6.7 on the Richter scale by 2030. FEMA officials believe San Francisco is better prepared than it was in 1989 when the last major quake hit the city. Eliza Chan is spokeswoman for FEMA's Region 9 office based in the Bay Area.
Local governments and also neighborhoods have done a lot in the last 10 years, especially working with FEMA and the state. We try to retrofit our infrastructures, such as our roads, bridges, and so forth. We also have given local governments mitigation grants so they can strengthen their public buildings, such as the beautiful San Francisco City Hall, Oakland City Hall. They are now certainly safe. We also have worked with local governments to put together bond measures. For example, in Berkeley, in Oakland, and in San Francisco, they have passed bond measures to raise funds to retrofit public buildings.
In addition, Chan says FEMA implemented a new program 2 years ago called Project Impact Communities that's designed to build stronger and safer communities.
Every time we build a home, we need to ask, is it disaster safe? We have been selecting local communities that have done work to encourage homeowners and businesses to be partners. For example, in Oakland, local government is working with banks so they could provide low-interest loans to homeowners when they retrofit their homes.
While local, state, and federal agencies can coordinate emergency response efforts when a major earthquake hits San Francisco or Los Angeles, FEMA's Eliza Chan says neighborhoods have to take responsibility for training themselves for such an emergency. She says citizens and families need to have their own plans in the event of a major quake, such as who will pick up the children, where the family will meet, and so on. FEMA also stresses that residents of San Francisco and L.A. need to have 3 days' worth of supplies in their homes, including water and medication. FEMA's message is that while a major earthquake could devastate areas, people who are prepared will have a better chance of surviving. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
When you hear about surface mining, the first thing that comes to mind are huge scars and holes in the earth, devoid of vegetation. In contrast, a mining project is being planned in Madagascar, the island off the east coast of the African subcontinent, which will create a forest as the mining takes place. The innovative thing about this mine is that it should help rather than degrade the ecosystem. Madagascar is under huge ecological stress as a rapidly expanding and very poor population struggles to meet its need for food, fuel, and shelter. The island, which broke away and evolved separately from Africa, is home to many unique species, such as the monkey-like lemur and 100 varieties of plants and animals that are found nowhere else on Earth. Jacques Gérin is an engineer and environmental consultant from Montreal, Canada. He's environmental advisor to the Rio Tinto company, which is planning a massive sand mining operation in Madagascar. He says the company wants to dig up sand on the surface of the ground with a dredge and extract titanium oxide, which is used as an alternative to lead in paint. The sand will be put right back in the same place and trees planted immediately. Gérin describes the process.
The dredge itself moves along at 2 or 3 feet a day, and it covers an area, a couple of football fields or 1,000 feet by 500 feet at any one point. And it moves gradually through the sand, extracts it, pulls it out, takes the mineral out, puts it back in. And you bring the topsoil back and you start replanting or reseeding or whatever is the case immediately thereafter. Over a period of 60 years, which is the lifetime contemplated for that mine, you'll cover about 60 square kilometers, which is probably something like 30 square miles. But that's at this few feet at a time, year in and year out.
Girard says the area to be mined has little of the original forest left.
Madagascar is a very unique country, and it's important in terms of world diversity, biodiversity, because it developed separate from the African continent, and its flora and fauna is quite unique. So if you had a healthy forest and a healthy Madagascar, you probably wouldn't even think of mining there. What we face, in fact, is a very rapid loss and degradation of the forest because of poverty. People use the forest for charcoal, for firewood, for lumber, and they just burn it for agriculture purposes. So the forest is receding at an extremely fast pace. In the areas of the proposed mining project, there are some remnants of good forest, but mostly for the two-thirds, it's already gone.
Girard says existing patches of natural forest will be saved, but one of the end results of the project is to provide fuel wood. This should relieve pressure on the natural forest, which is fast disappearing as trees are used for cooking fires.
The main replanting will in fact be with fast-growing species. That's often seen as monoculture and against biodiversity, but the strategy is to provide a quick supply of charcoal, lumber, and firewood that people will manage themselves and which, by using that as a source of energy, will reduce the pressure on the natural forest. So one of the outcomes of this mining project, beyond the jobs it will provide, is really to allow the people there to manage a source of energy that will be theirs and will hopefully provide a relief on the pressure on the natural forest.
The impetus for mining sand in Madagascar is to extract material that is mixed with it.
There's a mineral in there that's tied to the grain of sand that, when processed, becomes a titanium pigment, titanium dioxide, and that's a whitener and a thickener. And it's a product that you find in plastic, in paint. It's replaced lead in paint. You find it in paper. You find it in the sun protection coating, because it reflects sunlight. It's very thick. So it's a product that you never buy off the shelf, but that you will find in most of your everyday uses. So one of the questions is, why should you mine at all in Madagascar? And who are you is benefiting from that? And I guess ultimately it's us, the consumer, who uses plastic, paper, paint, and all these products.
I asked Jérôme whether, at the end of the cycle, people in Madagascar will feel the mine helped them or was simply an example of exploitation by a multinational corporation.
That's the very big challenge, and all we can say about that is that the company, Rio Tinto, because it has many years of experience around the world in projects that have been successful or not so successful, has made a very strong commitment that this project be beneficial not just to its shareholders but to the people there. At the moment, it's planned, but there's research and work on the ground, but it hasn't happened yet, and so you can only talk about it. Proof will be in the pudding. But also, I think one thing that I believe in very much is that if you're going to be there 60 years, you have time to correct as you go. This is not one big hole being blasted and you have to live with the consequences. And I say you'll be dredging a few feet a day, and if things don't work out the right way you do, you can change that. And no, there will not be mountains of sand piled aside, because they get replaced right back where they were before. In fact, I've walked through some of those areas in South Africa, and you can't tell the difference between the original forest and the one that was replanted. After 20 years, nature has taken over.
That was Canadian engineer and environmental consultant Jacques Girard, discussing a sand mining project in Madagascar, which is being designed to plant a forest as the mining takes place.
Thank you.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. We're always interested in your comments here at the Environment Show. Reach us through email, green at wamc.org, that's green at wamc.org, our toll-free number is 1-888-49-GREEN. Brilliant oranges, vibrant reds, and dazzling yellows. They're all colors associated with autumn in New England. For decades, the collage of colors has inspired artists. But according to Richard Nunley, a retired English professor at Berkshire Community College in Western Massachusetts and contributing essayist to the Environment Show, few early American writers actually took time to describe fall splendor. He prepared this essay, which is accompanied by Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, Autumn.
Once again, the bright colors of fall foliage have flamed over the northeastern United States and eastern Canada, and once again, thousands of tourists, the leaf peepers, have come from literally all over the world to see them. For a few October days each year, beginning with the higher altitudes and latitudes, each part of the region in turn ignites with the glory of glowing, vibrant red, vermilion, peach, salmon, russet, yellow, colors sharpened in intensity by the contrasting green of intermixed pine and hemlock and the overhead blue of the sky. Fall must have been happening ever since the retreat of the ice cap, but the early writers of New England say curiously little about the colorful change. They could hardly have not noticed that a sugar maple in their yard, which was as green as grass last week, this week has turned a screaming scarlet. Yet the explorer John Smith seems never to mention the fall color, nor does Edward Winslow of Plymouth, nor Governor Winthrop of Boston, nor Thomas Morton of Marymount, nor even the diarist Samuel Sewall, who is very careful to note the trees he sets out and the tree seeds he plants. The probable explanation is that, for them, the purpose of writing was not to emote or entertain so much as it was to report practical information about New England's economic resources and potential, to record events it was useful to remember, to reason and instruct, and to examine the conscience. Perhaps Cotton Mather, somewhere in the great mass of his scientific reports to the Royal Society in London, mentions the unusual colorfulness of the seasonal change in New England, but life is not long enough to page through his endless writings to see if he does. Not even Jocelyn, in his New England's Rarities Discovered in Birds, Beasts, Fishes, Serpents, and Plants of That Country, published in 1672, mentions fall foliage, although he does report how housewives cook pumpkin. As he says, they dice them up and stew them upon a gentle fire a whole day, and when stewed enough, they put butter to them and a little vinegar and some spice such as ginger and dish them up. The result, he warns, provokes urine extremely and is very windy. Poet Anne Bradstreet is the only one I've found who takes written note of the beauty of New England's fall foliage. She begins her long poem, Contemplations of 1678, thus. Some time now passed in the autumnal tide, when Phoebus wanted but 1 hour to bed, the trees all richly clad, yet void of pride, were gilded o'er by his rich golden head. Their leaves and fruit seemed painted, but 'twas true, of green, of red, of yellow, mixed hue. Rapt were my senses at this delectable view. This delectable excellence she sees as but a shadow of God's excellence. Not until the 19th century would most writers look at nature otherwise than as a source of emblems or analogies for theological abstractions or moral lessons. Then, with Romanticism's revolution in people's attitude toward nature, spread in part by painters' enthusiastic embrace of new synthetic pigments that could at last do justice on canvas to the color riot of fall, appreciating fall foliage became a popular mark of the sensitive soul. It still is.
Richard Donnelly is a retired English professor at Berkshire Community College in New England and contributing essayist to The Environment Show. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, organic feed corn is being picked in Wisconsin. It's part of the Great American Harvest. Dan Kaiser is production manager of Golden Harvest Farm in Cuba City, Wisconsin. The 300-acre operation is located in the southwest corner of the state, near the borders of Iowa and Illinois. Like many farmers, Dan uses a combine to harvest his organic corn.
The combine has 4 functions, actually. Cutting and feeding of the crop, that's where it's taking the ears off the stalks. The entering of the machine into a threshing area, which is the second stage, where the kernels of corn are then taken away from the cob. The cleaning area, then the corn passes through screens and sieves, which separate the chaff, the fines, and the dust and everything which falls out the back of the machine. And then the fanning mill does a final cleaning of the clean grain before it's delivered to the grain tank in the combine.
The cobs and the stalks are left on the field to return nutrients to the soil for next year's crop. Dan Kaiser says kernels that have been stripped from the cobs are taken to storage bins.
The grain can go in several types of structures. Usually metal storage bins are very common around this area. These bins may hold anywhere from 5 to 25,000 bushels. Some are even larger. It's put in there. The temperature is always checked. Moisture content is checked, and the grain is kept at a cool temperature to prevent any type of, say, condensation and, you know, something that could lead up to a mold around possibly bin edges, or if the corn is put in too wet, it sometimes can develop a hot spot in there because there's too much moisture.
Kaiser feeds his organic corn to his dairy cows. The milk they produce is marketed to a company called Organic Valley, a large producer of organic dairy products. Overall, Dan says this year's corn yield is comparable to recent years, but not as high as last year. The production process, from shelled corn to organic milk, is one that has been performed for centuries. It begins with the planting of seed, which Kaiser does right after the first week of May.
Once corn is planted, it's very important to get rotary hoeing out there, keep the topsoil loose, and knock out that first flush of weeds that is right at the soil surface. If a person could do this maybe 2 or 3 times before that corn gets up to 6 inches tall, that's about a 90% of a good combat on a weed program. From there on, cultivators go on and choose to cultivate it once, possibly 2 or 3 times. And by 4th of July, it's pretty much too tall to go through. At that point, Mother Nature's pretty much got it in her hands.
In mid-October, Kaiser checks the corn for moisture content and will harvest those fields with the right levels. Dan is an organic farmer, which means he does not use pesticides or herbicides on his corn crop. Other than rotating his crop with alfalfa and soybeans, Dan says he doesn't do much to combat pests. Organic farming is challenging, but it also is rewarding, knowing that as a farmer, you're not putting more toxic chemicals into the environment. Dan says self-discipline and hard work are characteristics that are needed to be an organic farmer. And he says you spend a lot of time hoping that Mother Nature works with you. Usually this is the part of the show where we offer some comical comment. Far be it from us, though, to take this opportunity to be corny. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we talk green about selling Great Lakes water. Should a private company sell water from the Great Lakes for its own profit, when the water belongs to all of us and we all pay to keep it clean? A green tip on stopping indoor air pollution when you put new varnish on your Stradivarius violin. And a group in Florida, co-founded by Jimmy Buffett, works to save the manatee. They're gentle beasts the size of a cow, but they can't avoid the motorboats. Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be discussing an issue which has caused a huge controversy, and that is whether a private company, or really whether anybody for that matter, ought to be able to sell water from the Great Lakes. The ruckus started last summer when the Canadian-based Nova Group proposed to ship 150 million gallons of water from Lake Superior to Asia. And officials in both the United States and Canada have called for a moratorium on water sales, and many urge an outright ban. And so with us to discuss this issue of sale of Great Lakes water is John Fabrero. He is president of the Nova Group. That's the Ontario company that proposes to sell Great Lakes water. And Mike Donahue, he's president of the Great Lakes Commission. That's an organization that represents the interests of 8 U.S. states that border the Great Lakes. Welcome to you both. And John Fabrero, let's start with you. What is it precisely that the Nova Group was proposing to do here?
Basically, what we were proposing was to take out 10 million liters a day of water via ship and sending it to the Asian market. And the proposal that we put forth was over a 60-day time frame, which amounts to 600 million liters per year over a five-year time frame.
That, I gather, is now on hold. Is that correct?
That's correct. What ended up happening, we put the proposal to the ministry here in Ontario. We got approval, and I guess we'll use the terminology that the Americans used, was called an international incident. And then I guess because of public outcry and political pressures, they've rescinded our permit. And basically what we did is we accepted that in principle, provided that we entertained a memorandum of understanding, and which we've done so here in Ontario.
Now, just to make it clear, you were going to sell the water to somebody else. Who was the buyer in this case?
The buyer, let's just say right now, would have been the Asian market.
I see. Okay. Well, that having been the situation, Mike Donahue from the Great Lakes Commission, what was wrong with this idea?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank John Fabraro and the NOVA Group for doing something that we've been unable to do for the past decade, which is raise the profile of water quantity management issues within the Great Lakes Basin. We at the Great Lakes Commission have been stating for about a decade now that we need much better data and information about how we're using our water resources so we can plan more intelligently for the future. And it wasn't until this proposal was elevated and moved this issue up on the policy agenda that it has received the attention that it deserves. At the Great Lakes Commission, on behalf of our eight member states, we had a couple levels of objections. The first level had to do primarily with the permit process. The Great Lakes states were surprised by the permit being granted. There was no binational consultation. We were also concerned that it appeared to be granted without any scientific data and information that would have allowed an informed decision to be made. And we also realized that there were a number of studies underway that could have helped with that decision. From a broader standpoint, we have some concerns about the bulk export issue in general. We're concerned about the notion of basically any private sector entity accessing a public sector water resource, and in essence offering it to the highest bidder. The U.S. and Canada have spent about $11 billion over the last couple decades to clean the lakes up, and we don't think that it was done with the idea of handing the water out to that highest bidder. We're also concerned about the cumulative impacts from an environmental and economic standpoint. If this sort of bulk export industry gets established, while the NOVA Group proposal itself wouldn't have had any measurable impacts just due to the modest size of the proposal, if we ultimately have the waterborne equivalent of a unit train of water being moved out of the Great Lakes, we're concerned that it be water quantity, water quality, and economic impacts.
Okay, well, before we get into the environmental issue, perhaps, John, you could help us with a question of if this is a public resource, if presumably we all have an interest in the Great Lakes, why should any private group be able to take the water and sell it?
I don't know if I can really answer that question per se, but let me say this. What we did, basically, we did quite a bit of research, and we noticed that there is a dire need overseas for some good quality water. Basically, what we did on our side was, look, we have Lake Superior here, and we looked at, now, right off the top of my head, I don't know how it translates to Imperial, but the metric number was 19 million liters was the threshold that apparently anyone could take that water out. Now,
anyone could take it out as a matter of law, or because they could pump that much?
They can go ahead and pump up to 19 million liters per day, provided that anything over and above would have to go to the International Joint Commission. To answer Michael's question, I think, on the process of no binational consultation, and I believe that's probably one of the reasons why it did not happen. When we looked at the way the laws stood, and there's a lot of loopholes in these laws, the way they stand today, and I'm glad to be, I guess, a catalyst, our company being a catalyst in making these changes. But where I'm getting at is 19 million liters was the threshold, and we took out 10 million liters. But that doesn't say, there's nowhere in the laws that say yourself, Peter, or, you know, Michael, or anyone for that matter, you know, there is a water-taking permit here in Ontario for purpose of taking water out. And basically what we did, we were above board, we followed the laws and rules and regulations the way they stood, and we applied, and we were granted that permit. Now, on the other hand...
So what I hear you saying is that the law allowed people to take up to this amount, and the fact that you were going to take it and sell it didn't change the fact that the law gave you the right to do that. I'd like to get to the issue, and we can talk about the law in a minute,
uh-huh.
But the notion that one can take and sell to a third party a public resource like this. Is that something, John, that as long as within certain limits, the Great Lakes Commission thinks is okay?
Well, I don't know if the Great Lakes Commission thinks it's okay. Mike,
let's hear you on that one.
There you go.
John, I'm sorry.
Well, our viewpoint at the Great Lakes Commission is our primary concern is proper use of the resource. And what we'd just like to see is a process with no loopholes where all the interested parties get together and come up with a mechanism that is, number one, scientifically sound, and number two, legally defensible to allow us to evaluate various types of proposals. Whether some types of water removals might be viewed as acceptable and some not is really not my primary concern. My primary concern is to come up with a process that is rigidly applied to all such proposals. So with all the data and information in front of us, those developing public policy can have a good, objective, and again, scientifically sound and legally defensible way of making these decisions.
All right. I'd like to hear from both of you on that subject. Let's assume you get over the hurdle of being able to sell this or do whatever you like to it. So the question then is how much water you can take out without having an ecological impact on the health of the lake. And I gather that what you're saying, Mike, is nobody's figured that out yet, and until that happens, we shouldn't go further. I'd like to hear from you both as to how one should make that determination. Mike, what does the commission say about how you figure that one out?
Well, what we do know from our own records is that every single day, about 959 billion gallons of water are withdrawn for various uses in the Great Lakes, St. Lawrence system. And of that, about 2.5 billion gallons are taken out and never returned, basically consumed. We also know that given the fact that the Great Lakes system is so intensively used, even though we have a large amount of water here, literally any sort of fluctuation in water levels up or down can have a tremendous economic impact. We also know that about 1% of the, if you end up taking out about more than 1% of the entire volume, I guess that's about the amount that's replenished on an annual basis. So eventually you'd kind of get into a mining situation where you're taking out more than is being placed into the system. And we're looking at climate change impacts where over the next 50 years we may see a net lowering of the Great Lakes by almost a meter. And if that's the case, we think that we need to be very conservative in our actions and make sure we don't put into place any sort of policy that could exacerbate a situation that already could be fairly problematic.
John Ferbero from the Nova Group, what Mike is saying is once you start taking it out, there's no end to it, and it hurts the lakes. How do you respond to that one?
I have to agree with Michael on that issue. Basically, I'm not a scientist that says that 1% of surface water is the maximum that can be taken out. But I think on an environmental standpoint, that the threshold of 19 million liters was put there for in legislation for a reason, and I believe that's probably the magic number where there's environmental impact. So if John Ferbero from the Nova Group takes out 10 million liters per day and somebody else takes out another 10, all of a sudden you surpass that 19 million liter threshold, and I think the cumulative effect will be detrimental to the Great Lakes.
So for you, the 19 million number is kind of the magic number. Mike, does the U.S. or does the Great Lakes Commission recognize this 19 million number? Where did that come from?
Well, being familiar with the development of the Great Lakes Charter of 1985, which set some trigger mechanisms, it basically stated that any proposal of 2 million gallons per day, and I can't do the conversion in my head immediately here, but there was a 2 million gallon per day trigger level where other jurisdictions needed to be notified of a proposed diversion or consumptive use. And then if it was going to be 5 million gallons per day or more, it will require consultation and approval and kind of a voluntary good faith arrangement. And that number was, there was a little bit of science that went into it, I guess I would say available science, but mainly it was developed to accommodate existing uses of the resource. And there's some efforts underway right now by the Great Lakes governors and premiers, by the International Joint Commission, and I serve on their international study team, and by the Great Lakes Commission as well, kind of working in concert to put some more science to this question, so in the future, when any type of proposal, whether it's the amount that the NOVA group proposed or any other entity proposing a different amount, we could apply some consistent standards to it and analyze it again in a scientifically sound and legally defensible way.
Well, until further work is done, are you more or less comfortable with the 19 million number, which John has talked about?
Actually, I personally am more comfortable right now with the notion of a moratorium on any type of bulk exports or any other removals that might set an uncomfortable precedent until the ongoing International Joint Commission study and some other studies are completed. And once we have that this process in place, then I think we can all come to the table and handle this proposal and any other proposals in a much more definitive and intelligent way than perhaps has been done to date.
I recognize that water sales and treating water as a commodity in international trade is something that is probably growing. I heard that there is a group that's exporting water from a river, I think, in British Columbia. John, does your enterprise see bulk sales of water as part of an ongoing and expanding area in trade? Is this something that, given the opportunity, groups such as yours will be expanding?
I think so, as you could appreciate, the more the water is deteriorating in third world countries, the more there's going to be a vast need. It's going to be at a premium here in Canada and the United States, and part of the United States for that matter. I mean, some parts of the United States are suffering themselves also. But I feel that bulk export will become a lot greater in the sense that a lot more companies will be trying to do this from other parts of the world. And again, it is a lucrative commodity in the next.
So how do you deal with the fairness issue that I think Michael raised at the beginning of our conversation? The public in both Canada and the United States has spent and continues to spend a great deal of money to upgrade the quality of the water. And does it seem fair then for a private enterprise, once this resource has been fixed up for everybody, just to take it out and sell it?
I believe that everyone has a right to that water. And if the laws allow us to take the water and use it, and you have enough capital and you have enough monies to go ahead and do it, it isn't a small project. I mean, it does involve a lot of dollars.
Would your group be prepared to pay for the water that it took out of the lake?
If we were asked to have a royalty and whatnot, we would have to look, and that all depends on what the payment is.
And so,
but I would have entertained the idea. There were some comments here from some on the Canadian side that why aren't royalties charged to the NOVA group on the amount of water they propose to take out and whatnot. The answer to that question was that was never brought to the attention. The water was there, the permit was there.
Michael, from the Great Lakes Commission, let's hear from you on this question of the equity and so on of selling the commodity after the public has paid to clean it up.
Well, a couple of points. First of all, I think it's important to note that the overwhelming majority of bulk export proposals globally, and we've done a lot of research into this, are not humanitarian in nature at all. They're basically for-profit initiatives to sell, quote-unquote, boutique water to the high-end market. So we have to distinguish between that motive and humanitarian motives. The second thing I'd say is that bulk export, in my opinion, is fundamentally unsustainable because what you're doing is perhaps propping up communities and societies that need to learn how to live within their means. And that might sound a little bit harsh, but I think if we were to get into the export business, we could do a much better job of exporting water conservation technology, water treatment technology, and sustainable communities technology to help communities learn how to live within their means, because once you turn on the tap out of the Great Lakes, it's going to only help others as long as that tap is going, and it's a shell game. You take it out of the Great Lakes, you'll have adverse impacts here if you're helping things elsewhere. So, yes, I'm in favor of export, but it's technology, not water.
I want to thank my guests, John Fabrero from the Canadian company Nova Group that wants to sell water from the Great Lakes, and Dr. Michael Donahue, president of the Great Lakes Commission. Since Great Lakes water is your water, too, you might have some views of your own about selling it. Share them with us. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN, and we've been talking green. I'm Peter Burley. Contact us here on The Environment Show. It's The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. Old-fashioned oil-based paints, some latex paints, and lacquers have a distinctive smell. Since most air conditioning and heating systems do not remove air contamination, the smell, and the indoor air contamination that it represents, concentrates in our homes when we repaint the den or refinish the dining room table. In apartment houses, central air systems frequently distribute pollutants from one apartment to another throughout the entire building. The classic paint smell is caused by volatile organic compounds, known as VOCs. VOCs have long been used as solvents in paint. They move into the air as the coating dries and frequently continue to be outgassed long after the repainted surface is dry to touch. VOCs are air contaminants that can have a terrible effect on the indoor environment. They could cause eye irritation, central nervous system symptoms, headaches, nausea, and dizziness. Modern chemistry has made it possible to create paint without VOCs. The result is you can paint the inside of your house, refinish the furniture, or repaint the old red wagon in your shop almost odor-free. The key is to use paint and lacquer made without VOCs. The EPA has set a standard of less than 250 grams of VOCs per liter for paint classified as low VOC. That's a classification primarily for paint to be used outdoors. But do not confuse that low VOC paint with paint that is VOC-free. Latex paint formulated without solvents has less than 1 gram of VOCs per liter. I painted a room with the stuff and was amazed to find there was no smell at all. If you plug VOC and paint into your web browser, you can find more stuff about redecorating your house or apartment without turning it into an indoor Superfund site than you will ever want to know. It is worth doing before you touch up the murals that Michelangelo painted on your living room ceiling, you change the color scheme in your master ballroom, or you slap a new coat of lacquer on that Stradivarius violin stuffed behind the old galoshes in the closet. That's our green tip for this week.
I'm Caitlin Kim, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, saving the manatee from extinction. West Indian manatees are killed or injured each year because of watercraft collisions or other human activities. In 1973, they were declared an endangered species. Part of the problem is lack of knowledge about manatees and where they live. That's why the Florida-based Save the Manatee Club emerged. Nancy Sadusky is communications manager for Save the Manatee Club.
Save the Manatee Club was started in 1981 by Bob Graham, who's a U.S. senator for Florida right now, but he was governor of Florida at the time. And he asked singer Jimmy Buffett to get involved, and Jimmy is still one of our co-chairpersons. So they actually founded the organization, and the idea behind it was to get people involved in helping to protect manatees so that we could save them from extinction.
The manatee is a very large and often misunderstood creature. It looks like a walrus without the tusks, but it's actually related to the elephant and not the walrus or whale as some folks think. It's gray in color and weighs between 1,000 to 12,000 pounds, and Sadusky says other misconceptions are...
A lot of people think that they were imported into Florida. They're an herbivore, so they eat aquatic plants. And so a lot of people think that they were actually brought into Florida to eat the aquatic plants here and to clear up, you know, the waterways. But actually, manatees were in Florida probably longer than humans have been. Manatees and their relatives have been in Florida for over 45 million years.
Save the Manatee Club has 40,000 members. About half of them are based in Florida, where manatees inhabit the waterways. And while many of the group's other members can be found throughout the U.S., about 500 of the group's members live outside of the U.S. The group concentrates its efforts in five areas: education, public awareness, manatee research, rescue, lobbying, and advocacy work. Financial support for these programs come from the group's Adopt a Manatee program. It funds about 90% of what they do. Nancy Sadusky says thus far their greatest accomplishment has been raising awareness about manatees.
The manatee is protected under the Florida Manatee Sanctuary Act and also the Endangered Species Act and also by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So manatees really have some good protection for them. And I think the main thing, you know, that we're trying to accomplish is to get people to recognize that manatees do need to be saved and to educate them about the things that they can do to help protect manatees. And so I think we've been relatively successful in that aspect of it.
The club handles thousands of requests for manatee information yearly. On average, the group presents manatee education programs somewhere in the U.S. about twice a week and staff festival booths about three times a week. Sadusky says they do this with good reason. There are only about 2,400 West Indian manatees left in the United States today, and Save the Manatee Club says they are working daily to preserve each and every one of them. If you'd like more information about Save the Manatee Club, you can log on to www.savethemanatee.org. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Caitlin Kim.
Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can flee the California earthquake by hiding in a sand mine in Madagascar if you can find the mine for the trees. Early American writers will keep you from being homesick, but you'll miss both the fall foliage, the manatees, as well as Great Lakes water, which is not for sale. You heard it here on show number 515. Order the show by calling 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby.
www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.